Chapter 29. Juan Cabrillo sat in his customary seat in the op center, listening intently to Holly Kasim's presentation. Eddie Seng hung out near the back of the room with Link and two gun dogs, Mike Trono and Jerry Pulaski. With Eric Stone's assistance, Holly had performed nothing less than a miracle. While Max was still broadcasting, I got in touch with a few amateur radio buffs I've gotten to know over the years, and had them tune in to Max's frequency. I had them jack the clocks that regulate our GPS satellites so we were 100% synchronized. As each character came through, I had them write down the exact time they received it. Now, the radio waves propagate at various speeds through various materials, so some extrapolations were necessary. That's where Eric came in. He computed out those discrepancies so we had a clear time versus distance calculation, and we were able to triangulate the transmitter's location. He typed at his computer for a moment, and an overhead picture of a barren island appeared on the main monitor. It was shaped like a teardrop ringed with cliffs, except for one inhospitable-looking rocky beach at the southern tip. The ground rose and fell in craggy hillocks, and there was virtually no vegetation except a few patches of grass and a couple of gnarled trees bent into odd shapes by the constant wind. According to the scale at the bottom of the picture, the island was roughly 8 miles long and 2 wide at its thickest point. This is Eos Island. It's located 4 miles off the coast of Turkey in the Gulf of Mandalay. The Greeks and Turks have fought over it for a couple of centuries, though judging by what we've found, I can't understand why. Geologically, it's interesting because it's a chunk of Precambrian bedrock in an otherwise active volcanic zone, but it is basically uninhabitable. This picture is dated 4 years ago. Just seeing a picture of where Max was being held sent a jolt of energy firing through Juan's body. It took him all he had not to order the Oregon to flank speed and charge in with guns blazing. Holly flashed another shot of the island on the screen. This was Eos Island last year. Clustered near the southern part of the island were a dozen large earth movers in distinctive yellow paint. A huge pit had been excavated and a cement plant had been erected. A dock had been extended from the beach and a road graded up to the work site. The work was done by an Italian heavy construction company and paid for through a numbered Swiss bank account, although there is little doubt who was behind it. The Turkish authorities were told it was going to be the largest movie set ever built. Up came another picture. This shows the same site a few months later. As you can see, they have built concrete structures inside their excavation. Eric added, "Using the heavy equipment to establish scale, the facility's footprint is nearly 50,000 square feet, and at this point in the construction, it has 3 levels. Holly picked up their story again. 8 months into construction, the bogus movie company said they ran out of money and were pulling the plug on the project. As part of the original contract with the Turks, they were supposed to return the island to its natural state. So that is, more or less, what they did." He brought up a third picture on the main monitor. There was no sign of the massive excavation. It looked as if nothing had ever happened. All of the material removed from the pit had been returned to it, and the surface was reconfigured so to appear like natural stone. The only thing remaining was the dock and a macadam road that led seemingly nowhere. "This picture is from the official Turkish government environmental impact report," Holly continued. "We have to assume that some bakshish exchanged hands and the report was doctored to indicate that Eos was back to normal." "Where's the ELF antenna?" Juan asked. "Buried beneath the underground bunker," Eric replied. "Max was very specific when he said in his message to nuke it. He could have easily said, bomb it. Same number of letters, so it wouldn't have added to the transmission time, but he specifically used the word nuke." I would have liked to consult Mark about this, but I did a quick computer simulation, and if they were pouring concrete for 5 or 6 months and then piled the debris on top, I estimate it will take probably 2 kilotons to crack that nut open. Why not one of the Air Force's bunker buster bombs? Juan asked smartly. That would work fine so long as we hit either the antenna or the power generators directly. But looking at this from a purely practical point of view, do you see us getting our hands on one of those? Eric had a habit of not getting sarcasm. No more than us finding 2,000 tons of TNT, Juan shot back, instantly regretting his sharp tone. Sorry. He tried to never take his frustrations out on his people. Commando raid seems the only way, Eddie said, and moved up from the back of the op center. We could hit the beach there on the south tip of the island, or try to scale one of the cliffs. The chance of success is statistically zero, Eric replied. Probability dictates that the entrance to the bunker is heavily defended and easily sealed. At the first sign of an attack, the outer defenses are closed off, and successive barricades within the bunker will be raised. So we find a back door, Juan suggested. There have to be air intakes for the ventilation system, as well as vents for the exhaust from their power plant. Both of which, I believe, lie under the dock. Eric nodded to Holly, who brought the first construction picture back up on the screen. Look carefully at where they are still working on the road. Holly manipulated the picture to zoom in on where a paving machine was laying down a ribbon of asphalt. Just ahead of the machine, graders were smoothing the track, while a bit farther ahead, excavators were laying dirt into a deep trench. They dug out under where the road was going to be laid in order to bury the vent pipes and then layered blacktop over it. Again, we have to assume that the intakes and vents are well guarded and that at the first sign of an intrusion, the facility goes on lockdown. A team might be able to gain access to the conduits, but once inside, they would be trapped. Juan glanced at Eddie to get his opinion of Stone's grim assessment. Seng said, "One misstep and we would be targets at a shooting gallery. And even if we made it in, we'd have to cut ourselves out of those pipes with torches, not knowing who or what is waiting to greet us." "Okay, give me another option," Juan said. "Sorry, German, but Eric's right. Without knowing how that place is laid out, its security systems, guard strengths, and about 100 other things, we can't get inside. 2 weeks ago, we stole a pair of rocket torpedoes from the damned Iranian Navy. There has to be a way to get Max out of there." "With all due respect," Eric's voice was hesitant but determined, "our focus should be on silencing that transmitter rather than on Max's rescue. If the attack is coordinated using an ELF signal to cruise ships scattered all over the globe, then its destruction should be our primary concern." The silence was long and pregnant. "Do you have a suggestion?" Juan asked with stiff formality. "Actually, I do, sir. It's called Stalin's Fist." The code name rocked Juan back in his chair. "How do you know about that?" "I read through the transcripts of our intercept between Ivan Karikov and Ibn al-Asim. Those transcripts were on Juan's computer, but he hadn't had the time to peruse them, let alone read them in their entirety. Anyway, they were the CIA's bailiwick, as far as he was concerned. They had been hired to eavesdrop, not sift through the information. Karikov mentioned he had access to something called Stalin's Fist. When he mentioned it, I did some research. You're familiar with it?" "Why do you think it doesn't work?" Juan asked with a smirk. "You boys mind filling us in?" Link called. Eric typed at his computer and brought up an artist's rendition of a satellite, unlike anything ever orbited before. The main body was a long cylinder, and ringing it were 5 enclosed canisters that were more than 30 feet in length. No one needed to see the hammer and sickle emblem on its side to know it was Russian. The drawing itself had that distinctive Soviet style that was both pompous and amateurish at the same time. Eric commenced, "Though its real code name was November Sky, it was known almost exclusively by the nickname Stalin's Fist. It was launched in 1989 at one of the warmest periods during the Cold War in direct violation of about a dozen treaties." "That's all fine and dandy," Link grumbled, "but what in the heck is it?" "Stalin's Fist is an OBP, or orbital ballistic projectile, weapon. Our military played around with the idea, calling it rods from God. The theory is incredibly simple. Inside those tubes are tungsten rods weighing 1,800 pounds apiece. When fired, they fall through the atmosphere and hit whatever they're aimed at. Coming in at an orbital velocity of 18,000 miles per hour, multiplied by their mass, they hit with the kinetic energy of an atomic bomb. Only there is no fallout, and defensive reaction time to such a weapon is cut in half because there is no ascent stage like with a conventional ballistic missile. You might see a flaming object in the sky for a moment, but that's it. No warning, and no chance to escape." "The Soviets intended it as a first strike weapon," Juan added. "The idea was to target several major Western cities lying along the same longitudinal axis and blame a freak meteor shower. With no radioactive fallout and the rods themselves vaporized on impact, there would be no way to say it wasn't. They even had astronomers ready to show doctored photographs of the meteors moments before they entered our atmosphere. With the Western world reeling from losing five cities, the Sovs thought they could roll across the border and Europe would be theirs." "How do you know it didn't work?" Eric asked Juan. "Because one of my first black ops for the agency was to infiltrate the Baikonur Cosmodrome, where it was being launched on an Energia rocket, and disable it. I rigged it so the satellite couldn't receive a signal from the ground because of Earth's magnetic field. It will only react if the order comes from above the atmosphere."
"Why not just blow it up on the pad?"
"It was a manned mission. Two cosmonauts went up with it to manually deploy its solar panels. It was 3 days into the mission before they discovered the bird had been sabotaged."
Holly asked, "They couldn't just boost a ground signal?"
"It would have fried the electronics."
"Couldn't they have sent a signal from Mir, their space station?"
"They knew the jig was up, so they left it floating around up there in a polar orbit."
"Do you think it still works?" Eric asked.
"Unless it's been hit by space debris, it should work perfectly."
Cabrillo was warming to the idea.
"Okay, Hotshot, you found us an alternative to a nuke. How do you propose we get a transmitter 60 miles into space so we can commandeer the satellite?"
"If you can get me the codes from Ivan Karikov," Stone typed again and brought up yet another picture, "I'll get it up there using this." Juan and the others stared slack-jawed for a moment at the audacity of the plan. Cabrillo finally found his voice.
"Eric, you got yourself a deal. I'll call Overholt to arrange your transport. Eddie and Link, come up with a plan to get those codes from the Russian arms dealer tonight. Then, we leave port."
"You still want to head to Eos Island?" Eddie asked.
"I'm not abandoning Max."